Okay, there we go. So, David, when you finish, leave it on the last slide, and we'll keep that going, and then it will record our fabulous discussion.
Okay. These things have a way of breaking when I touch them. Thank you, Margaret, John, Dr. Clark. Anyway, it's great to be here. I haven't been to an ASHS meeting in quite some time, not because I don't want to come, but because we get really busy with growers visiting us this time of year. Last week we had about 150 growers from around the world visit us, and unfortunately I don't always get to come to these meetings as much as I'd like. Well, I was supposed to keep this pretty brief, and so I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I'm from Maine, and I went to undergraduate at the University of Maine in plant soil sciences sometime in the last quarter of the last century, and I then went to graduate school at Michigan State University, graduated there in January of 1978, and my first job was with the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Fresno, California, working on table grapes, raisin grapes, and grape rootstocks. I left there in about 3 years, went to Clemson University, where I was a stone fruit breeder, and was there about 6 years. Can't keep a job. I don't know why. But then I went to California to Superior Farming Company, which was subsequently purchased by Sun World International, and I worked there for about 13 years. And in 2001, I left there to start International Fruit Genetics. And we can talk about, is there a pointer?
There is no pointer. You can use your manual pointer.
Okay. So, this is me. Look at my hair color. Look how I'm still growing. So. Anyway, this is the owners of the company, Craig and his dad, Glenn Stoller. They are large grape nurserymen in California, have one of the large grape nurseries in California. And then the other gentleman here is Jack Pandel. He's a large grape grower in California, and somehow I talked them into starting a grape breeding program, and then I talked them into also, we work on low-chill cherries as well, so which is a kind of a minor part of the program, but actually is doing well. So we're located near the city of Delano, in the central south part of the San Joaquin Valley, in the center of the table grape region. We have 80 acres of fields and test plots there, and we have a laboratory where we do tissue cultures. It's actually a 1938 old farmhouse that we equipped for a tissue culture lab, but it seems to be has been working for quite a while. We'd like to think of ourselves as reinventing the table grape industry, looking at consumer and retailer traits and grower traits, and I'll talk a little bit more about those in a second. We have really four aspects of the business: the research and development, which is kind of the engine that drives everything. We are in 14 countries around the world. We have, about 700 or 800 growers signed up around the world, and in most of the more important countries, we have a technical staff that helps growers with cultural practices, trying to optimize the conditions for each one of our varieties. Then we have a quality assurance program. One thing that we do that's interesting is that we don't sell the plant material. We basically, it's like a Microsoft Windows. It's a use license or a lease. So you get to use the plant, but you never actually own the plant. So you can use it to produce a crop. And anyway, this gives us the ability to set our own quality standards, mostly sugar acid ratios, that are higher than the industry as a whole. So that automatically makes our varieties taste better, even if it's more or less, say, the same quality. If you're picking a grape at 16 bricks versus 20 bricks, it's a much better eating experience. So then we are an intellectual property company, and so we do have legal aspects. We do PBRs, PVRs, plant variety protection, utility patents, trademarks, all that sort of thing. We just recently hired an in-house attorney, and unfortunately people do want to steal your plant material if it's good, and so we spend a lot of money each year enforcing our rights. One interesting thing that we just did, I see Terrence here, our, my competitor, if I say anything, you got to go like this, maybe. Right. But the four big private breeding companies around the world have actually formed a fifth company that's an intellectual property protection company, and we are setting up a joint database and doing joint monitoring of markets in around the world to look for illegal production of our varieties, and we're cooperating in that sense. The goals are pretty much the same as all the breeding programs. Consumer traits, we're working on all colors, seedlessness in the vinifera. I'm not going to talk anything about the cherries, but vinifera flavors, muscats, and exotic, meaning Vitis labrusca type flavors, and so these traits are pretty much what anybody would want. One of the things John mentioned that I think has been a real benefit to our program is we did talk him into giving us an exclusive license for some of their breeding lines, and this is we've incorporated this material into our breeding program pretty extensively, and I think it's been beneficial to both us and the university, and I think it's a good example of public-private cooperation that can go on. Top six countries we're in: United States, Peru, Mexico, Chile, South Africa, and Brazil. And the top five varieties: Sweet Celebration, which is a late season, Red Seedless, Sweet Globe, which is a mid-season white, very crisp texture, Sweet Sapphire, which has a unique shape and good eating quality, Jack Salute, which is a later Red Seedless, and Cotton Candy, which has a unique flavor. I think I'm going to stop there, and because we want to have a discussion, and I've got some pictures of those varieties. You want me to just scroll to the end?
Yeah, you can just take some pictures and scroll if you want.
Okay. So that's Sweet Celebration, Sweet Globe, Sweet Sapphire, which has this unique elongated shape with a dimple. This does really well. The Chinese just are crazy about this variety. Unfortunately, they're a little too crazy, and now we have a lot of acres of it in China that we're trying to corral, and Cotton Candy, which is has its own sort of cult following at this point. So that's where we'll leave it.
Great. And we'll wait for questions until everybody's done. And I'm going to leave this up, even though it has David Kane's contact information, while the Driscoll's folks talk, because I made PowerPoint optional. So they didn't slack off. I told them they didn't have to. So I'll let John continue.
It's somewhere in the early 2000s or so that I learned about somebody I'd never heard of before in 1 minute, and the next thing I heard about somewhere I'd never heard of either. The person was Phil Stewart, and the second place was Alfred University. Now, how many of you know where Alfred University is? Old Marvin Pritz, the stuff he knows. Okay. Well, Alfred University is upstate New York. It's in Cuba, is that right, or somewhere
no,
up there?
No, it's the same county.
Okay. So anyway, Phil Stewart emailed me and wanted to come to graduate school at the University of Arkansas. He got a degree in biology up at Alfred, and he'd been working at this New York State Ag Experiment Station with Bruce Reich in the grape breeding program and got interested in grape breeding. And my memory was that you wanted to learn about whole plant breeding, and Bruce says, well, why don't you go down to Arkansas? That's all they know how to do. Is that? And so he contacted me and came on down and did a fine job, worked on a blackberry project, and went on to the University of Florida and got his PhD. And I don't know why this occurred this way, but one day I was standing at a rabbit eye blueberry field somewhere in southern Georgia, and the phone rang. By then, fortunately, I had gotten a phone. I put it off for a long time. And some boss at Driscoll was calling me and saying, you know, this Phil Stewart guy's applied for a strawberry job out here. Is he any count? Now, he didn't say that exactly like that. That's a southernism. And I said, yeah, you know, Phil has gotten done everything put before him. I bet you'll do you a good job. I'd hire him. So now, Phil Stewart has worked at Driscoll for a number of years in strawberry breeding. He's the global leader for strawberry breeding. Now, Phil, that's way ahead of the days back at Alfred. Tell us how you got there.
Well, thanks, John. You've stolen about half of what I was going to say. But, now, as John said, I started at Alfred with a biology degree, and honestly, I don't think I even knew plant breeding existed until about a month before I started working as a plant breeder. I had a bio degree. I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do with my life, and I ran into my mother's cousin's husband at a family gathering, and he worked at Cornell in entomology. And so he was looking for summer help, so I applied for that. And they took their time making a decision. In the meantime, my application was on file, and the grape breeding program called me. And I figured I didn't have a job, so you know that sounded like biology. So I would go do that. And so a three-month summer job turned into a year, turned into 5 years. And at that point, I decided that making more than $10 an hour sounded good. I went to Arkansas and made about that, but one thing led to
quality fail.
Yeah. But anyway, so I started out in grapes and I moved on to blackberries, and worked in John's program, which was a pretty traditional breeding program, which was what I wanted to do really. But at the end of that, I decided that maybe to work in plant breeding today, I need to get a little bit of a molecular background. So I went to the University of Florida. I worked with Craig Chandler and Kevin Folta. And Kevin made sure that I had far more molecular background than I actually wanted. But it served me pretty well. So I started at Driscoll's about 12 years ago. And I started out, I was the Central District strawberry breeder, which was kind of a play on words because I was Central California, Central Mexico, and Central Florida. And after about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I took over heading all the North American strawberry breeding, which is what I do today. I've gone through a series of increasingly grand-sounding titles to get there, but essentially it's the same job with more meetings. So I guess before I go a little further into my job, I'll talk a little bit about Driscoll's. I think most of you probably know who Driscoll's is. In fact, I'm sure a lot of you do because I recognize a lot of you. But we're a berry company, probably the biggest berry company, at least in North America. We do strawberries, blackberries, raspberries, and blueberries. And Jessica will talk more about the blueberries in particular, but I do strawberries. Our model is kind of unusual, although there's some similarities to what David described, really. We're essentially a genetics company and a marketing company. So we develop the varieties, and then we license them to the growers under a license, a lot like what David was talking about. We never really give up ownership of the plants. We rent them to them, essentially. And as part of that contract, they are required to sell them back to us. So we create the varieties, contract growers, grow them for us, and then we handle the marketing. And we've kind of positioned ourselves as a premium variety, premium company. That's sort of our niche. Hopefully, we usually deliver on it. And we get a premium over the market in terms of price, but the growers also pay a percent back to us to support our research and marketing. And the growth of the company has been absolutely incredible. I think it's doubled every 5 years since 1990. So it, just in the time I've been there, it's gone from a small company to depends on what you compare it to, but a pretty large company. And there's a lot of changes that come with that, some of them exciting, some of them kind of frustrating. I spend a whole lot more time in meetings and less time in the field than I used to, but I still get out to the field. And we're in quite a few countries. I don't remember how many countries off the top of my head. 20. We grow in 20-odd, and we ship to about 20 more. But the bulk of our business is really U.S. and Mexico. But we also have a presence in Europe, in China, in Australia, New Zealand, Chile. So it's been a really fun company to work at in terms of a lot of opportunities for travel, to meet new people and see new places. And it's a pretty extensive breeding program. So, you know, I think one thing that I've really appreciated is the ability to do a whole lot of things at a scale that I might not have been able to in a public program. So for me personally, I'm in charge of the global strawberry breeding effort, and I run the Watsonville strawberry breeding program myself, but there's five other breeding programs who have breeders that report into me. So, you know, I'm getting kind of a mix of the hands-on breeding with supervising people in other locations who are essentially running those breeding programs themselves, and I'm just sort of providing oversight and coordination. One thing I've done a lot of while I've been there, I think, is I've really helped move us into the molecular aspects of breeding. Driscoll's had started on that when I started, but along with Judd Ward, who is our molecular leader, we've really expanded that. And we now do marker-assisted seedling selection and parent selection as a matter of course on a pretty large scale. So recently we've been putting a lot of effort into the flavor aspect of things, which I think is pretty exciting because it's one of those things that seems like a pretty intractable trait. As we start to make headway into breaking it down and figuring out what goes into that, there's a lot of interesting science that happens there, and it's more manageable than you'd think, but not easy. So that's really where Driscoll's wants to put our effort. But the reality is that yield and fruit size and harvest efficiency and all these things, if you breed just for flavor, it's a good way to breed things that no one will ever grow. As much as we like to think that that's the be-all, end-all. People always ask, what do you breed for? And it's like, it's a long, long list. And I think it's one of the really delightful things about breeding berries, but it's also one of the sort of frustrating things is that it is a long list, and you have to sort of keep your eye on all of it. So, we're breeding for flavor, but we're also breeding for yield and fruit size and shelf life, and especially harvest efficiency has gotten big with the cost of labor in California and just shortages of labor in general. And disease resistance, as we lose fumigants and other chemical options, disease resistance gets bigger and bigger. It's always a balancing act, and you're always making compromises. And it's sort of challenging sometimes when you have to go to growers and tell them you're making those compromises. And same thing when you go back to the salespeople and things like that. But it's always an exciting interaction. So I think it's been a really satisfying career path, and hopefully one that I continue on for a while.
Thank you.
I think John's got embarrassing.
So we're moving to the newly developed wisdom area of our show. Dr. Jessica Gilbert is our next speaker. I've admired Jessica for, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 years. I can't remember when. I'm sure the first time I saw you was at ASHS, probably giving a presentation. Thought, boy, you look mighty smart. Now, Jessica, one reason I admired you, because I've always admired your advisor, Jim Olmstead, when he was about your age back about that time and did a fine job. Jessica came to see me in the summer of 2015. It was interesting. She drove up in her car, had a bicycle strapped on the back of it. Saturday, she had just walked in commencement at University of Florida. And this is, I think, Tuesday that she came to see me at Clarksville, Arkansas, where we have our research program, our fruit research station. She was headed toward the Tetons for a vacation after finishing her degree, is what I remember. And I thought, now, she's pretty smart to do something like that. So we looked around the station, and the reason she came by is we had just determined we would add an additional fruit breeder that I would get to work with for a number of years, and she had gotten wind of the job, and she was on her way to the Teton, so she came by to visit. So we rode around the station, and when she got done, I admired her more, and I thought, boy, this will be fun to work together. She knows a bunch of stuff that I don't know, and I know 10 or 12 stories that I could tell her for the next 5 or 6 years. Well, anyway, she went on and got this job at Driscoll, so she never applied for the job. But the Lord works in mysterious ways, and I've got another bright young person that came along. That now
I'd
she's
like to
hearing
thank
the stories.
Jessica for not applying for the job.
So you can tell I was in a good spot, because there were smart folks all around. So Jessica's our third speaker. She's a molecular breeder. Kind of bringing a little different angle as far as not only time, a little bit of approach. So, Dr. Gilbert, share with us.
Thank you, John. I'm really impressed you remember all the details of my graduation and our visits. Very flattering. So, I'm Jessica Gilbert. When I was growing up, I would have never dreamed that I would have a career in agriculture. I grew up in Miami, where I thought that a forest was the trees that grow in the median of a highway. So I found, like much like Phil, I found plant breeding very late in life. As an undergraduate student, I was studying microbiology and cell sciences. I wanted to go make drugs. And then in my last year as an undergrad, I took a plant molecular biology course with Dave Clark, and in his class, he would talk about his research into the aroma of flowers and flavor in fruits, and it blew my mind that someone actually considered that a field of research. And so I abandoned my bugs, and I started working in Dave's lab a little bit in conjunction with Jim Olmstead, who was the blueberry breeder at the University of Florida at the time. And so I started dabbling in some volatile research in blueberries. It was going really well, so Dave and Jim offered me a fellowship to stay and do a PhD on blueberry flavor biochemistry, which I accepted. And then fortunately the timing was quite amazing. As I was graduating with my PhD, this position for a molecular blueberry breeder was posted at Driscoll's, and I got the job and moved out to California, and it's been a really wonderful experience. The molecular blueberry breeding position was a brand new role at Driscoll's, so I got to see the building of our molecular foundation for the program from ground zero, which has been really scary at first, but also very exciting to get to mold everything in the way that you see fit. Obviously with lots of help from our molecular team and the other breeders that have been there before me. So I'm primarily responsible for designing projects to determine the traits of interest that we want to pursue as markers. So what do we think might be a qualitative trait and have some sort of simple inheritance that we can find a gene for and then develop a marker. So a lot of development of how do you phenotype something? Where do you phenotype something? Because traits oftentimes are very environmentally variable. And then one of the large differences from graduate school to this is it has become a lot more of project management, where instead of doing this whole project of determining the phenotypes of flavor and all the molecular downflow from this, I get to hand off multiple parts of these projects to experts that know what they're doing much better than I would, and just, you know, making sure all these pieces of the puzzle come into time just right as season is rolling through, that no one is missing the fruit that they need. So that is the molecular aspect of my work. And then I've also taken on the pre-breeding, so collecting wild germplasm, whether it's from the National Germplasm Repository or personal collections, to begin to incorporate traits that we don't have in the commercial blueberry breeding program right into our germplasm. And then we're also now beginning to try to be more molecular about that so that we can have less linkage drag, just be more constructive with our wild germplasm. Yeah, so I've been there 4 years, and hopefully I'll be there for many more years. Thank you. Great.